Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga.
We are saying until Cameroon stop killing our children and withdraw their soldiers back to their own territory, there will be no schooling in Ambazonia. We have to stop lamenting and begin to act up and let the world see the outrage in us.
Residents of an English-speaking city in northwest Cameroon take to the streets to protest the killing of an 8-year-old girl by the police as armed separatists launch attacks on government forces.
What we're seeing, both in Tigray, but also as we have different forces and different ethnic groups that are increasingly at odds.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he is concerned that Ethiopia might implode unless all parties stop military action and engage in political dialogue.
And one of the challenges is that when you distribute the nets, you will find that especially along the lake, these nets are no longer used for sleeping in. They are used for some other things, for fishing and all sorts of things.
And Malawi begins a mass distribution of mosquito nets, aiming to reach almost half the country's population of 18 million people. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Schools and economic activity have completely shut down in Bamenda, an English-speaking city in northwest Cameroon, after police opened fire, killing an 8-year-old girl. Several hundred irate residents took to the streets protesting the killing, while armed separatists have launched attacks on government forces, asking the military to leave Bamenda. Moki Edwin Kinzikam reports from Bamenda in western Cameroon.
Civilians shout as Cameroonian troops shoot in the air to stop people from protesting Saturday along the streets of Bamenda, capital of Cameroon's restive English-speaking northwest region. Police said in a statement that residents are protesting Friday's killing of 8-year-old Tato Brandy by a police officer in Bamenda. According to the statement signed by Cameroon's police chief, Martin Bargangele, police wanted to immobilize a suspected vehicle and a bullet mistakenly hit and killed the 8-year-old. Civilians marched with the girl's dead body, calling for justice to be done. The police statement said separatist fighters infiltrated the protesting civilians. Deben Chofo is the governor of the Northwest region.
L'auteur du coup de feu a été mis aux arrêts et sera sévèrement sanctionné conformément aux lois et règlements de la République.
Chofo says he gave instructions and the police officer suspected to have opened fire that killed the girl was arrested. He says investigations have been opened to determine whether the bullet that killed the girl was actually from the police officer's rifle. Chofo says he is pleading with civilians to not heed calls by separatists to close schools and businesses as a sign of discontent over what they consider military and police brutality towards civilians. The protesters are asking the military to leave the streets, but the government says the troops are deployed to protect civilians from separatists fighting to create an independent state called Ambazonia. Chris Anno is Secretary for Communication at what separatists call the Ambazonia Interim Government. Anno, in a declaration shared on social media platforms after the child was killed, said fighters have been in running battles with government troops. He says separatists have ordered civilians to go out to the streets as a sign of protest against military and police brutality and the killing of civilians.
We are saying until Cameroon stop killing our children and withdraw their soldiers back to their own territory, there will be no schooling in Ambazonia. We have to stop lamenting and begin to act up and let the world see the outrage in us.
ANU said fighters have been instructed to make sure that schools which were authorized to open their doors this year are closed. Rights groups say children and women are increasingly being targeted by both government forces and separatists. Nicolene Nwenushi Waze is a member of Cameroon Women's Peace Movement. The movement negotiates with government troops and fighters to both drop weapons for a return to peace in Cameroon's western regions. Waze says both fighters and the military should spare civilians, especially women and children.
I add my voice to deplore such acts and urge all parties to the crisis to exercise maximum caution and avoid civilian casualties. Parties to the conflict must adhere to international humanitarian laws and keep children out of harm's way. Spare the population from all this trauma and panic.
Separatists have been fighting since 2017 to create a breakaway English-speaking state in the majority French-speaking country. The separatists complain of marginalization and discrimination by the French-speaking majority. The United Nations says that the fighting has displaced more than 500,000 people and killed more than 3,000 civilians. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bamenda, Cameroon.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he's concerned that Ethiopia might implode unless all parties stop military action and engage in political dialogue. As VOA's senior diplomat correspondent Asinde Sain reports, Blinken is headed to Africa this week for talks in Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal at a time when many worry that Ethiopia's year-long war in the Tigray region may be worsening into a deeper conflict.
Tensions in Ethiopia have risen following reports that Ethiopian authorities have rounded up hundreds of Tigrayans, including some who are United Nations and African Union staff members, days after the government declared a state of emergency. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke about the situation Friday at the State Department.
I am very concerned about the potential for Ethiopia to implode, given what we're seeing, both in Tigray, but also as we have different forces and different ethnic groups that are increasingly at odds.
In the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, where officials have urged residents to take up arms to defend themselves, Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson Dina Mufti had this to say about the detained UN and African Union staff members. Dina Mufti is the Ethiopian Foreign Affairs spokesperson.
Ethiopia's state of emergency.
There is a force that is undertaking measures to ensure the rule of law prevails in Ethiopia. A resident UN staff should respect the law of the country. They are not in space. They are in Ethiopia. They have to respect Ethiopia's law one by one. If they don't respect the law of the land, they will be legally held accountable, whether they are a UN or African Union staff.
Blinken said Friday the United States is working closely with the African Union envoy for the Horn of Africa, Olusegun Obasanjo, who is shuttling back and forth between Ethiopia and Kenya to help broker a ceasefire in the conflict that has left thousands dead and hundreds of thousands facing famine. Persuading the parties to hold talks is the only good path forward, former Ambassador Makila James tells VOA.
Dialogue is the only long-term solution because this is a war that could drag on for a long time with no winners and lots of losers.
Ethiopia is likely to be high on the agenda as Blinken makes his first in-person trip to Africa as Secretary of State next week, visiting Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal. Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo traveled to Africa in February of 2020, including a visit to Ethiopia. Competition between the U.S. and China for business and influence in Africa was a major theme during that visit. This time, the State Department says the secretary is focusing on African solutions for African problems. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Malawi has begun a mass distribution of mosquito nets aiming to reach almost half the country's population of 18 million people. Health authorities say the campaign is aimed at reducing the spread of malaria, which in Malawi currently accounts for 36% of all hospital outpatients and 15% of hospital admissions. Lameka Masina reports from Blantyre.
The Global Fund supported the campaign was announced during the commemoration of the Southern Africa Development Community Malaria Day and is expected to be rolled out nationally November 15. Kumbize Kandodo Chiponda, Malawi's Minister of Health, says the intervention is a response to the health threat malaria is posing in Malawi.
So one of the interventions is the distribution of the nets as vector control. As a country, we are going to distribute 9 million nets. Our target is that at least two Malawi has the share in it. At least our population, we are targeting, we have about 18 million. So that is why we reached at the figure of 9 million.
She says during the campaign, all expectant mothers will be given anti-malaria drugs to prevent them from suffering from malaria while pregnant. Statistics show that malaria is number one deadly disease in Malawi. Last year alone, malaria killed 2,500 people in Malawi, more than any other disease, including COVID-19. However, Kadodo says the campaign is strewn with challenges.
And one of the challenges is that when you distribute the nets, you will find that, especially along the lake, these nets are no longer used for sleeping in. They are used for some other things, for fishing and all sorts of things.
To reduce the changes of such misuse of the nets, the campaign also involves teaching the recipients about the importance of sleeping under the net. The mosquito net distribution is part of the Zero Malaria Starts With Me campaign launched by President Lazarus Chakwera in June as part of a global campaign to end malaria by 2030. Elias Mpedi Magosi is the executive secretary at the Southern African Development Community. He commends Malawi's efforts to eradicate malaria and says the bloc is working to adopt a regional malaria strategy.
Primarily because if one country or one member state removes or clears malaria, because it knows no boundaries, these mosquitoes know no boundaries, they'll just relocate to another country. So it requires a pooled regional effort of resources, attributes and behaviors so that it's actually eliminated.
Janet Kaita, the World Health Organization country representative in Malawi, says the campaign is among major steps Malawi has successfully taken against malaria.
Malawi has been exceptional in taking forward WHO recommendations, whether that's to do with how to prevent malaria, how to treat malaria. But the most historic, groundbreaking event in the last 1 month, actually, that Malawi is at the forefront of is this, the information that is coming out about the new malaria vaccine for infants and children.
Last month, the WHO endorsed the world's first malaria vaccine for children across Africa following a successful three-year trial in Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi. Although it is only 30% effective, scientists say the vaccine, known as Mosquirix, will have major impact against malaria in Africa, which records 200 million cases and 400,000 deaths per year. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
A report by Amnesty International documents several violent forced evictions in Uganda of the Benet indigenous people. Affected members of the community narrate details of the eviction from their ancestral land, saying it took place without notice, and they're asking the Ugandan government to compensate them. Halima Athman reports from Kampala.
More than a decade after being violently evicted from their ancestral forest lands in Mount Elgon, Amnesty says Uganda's indigenous Benet people continue to languish in deplorable conditions. This includes living in ramshackle resettlement camps with little access to clean water, sanitation, and healthcare for 13 years, according to a report by Amnesty International. The report, titled 13 Years in Limbo, Forced Evictions of the Benet in the Name of Conservation, found that the Benet are still suffering disruption to their way of life, and they remain at risk of physical harm from forest rangers despite repeated promises by the government to resettle them. David Chemtai is an affected member of the Benet group. He says that through the different evictions, about 100 people have since lost their lives and many remain psychologically traumatized.
The UWA officials came, they forced us to burn our own houses. They give you the matchbox and they have a gun and they tell you that, please burn your house. You have no alternative. The food is inside. The properties are inside. We had nowhere to go, and we had to reside in under the trees and under the caves.
Roland Ebole, a researcher at Amnesty International, says the evictions among a community of 18,000 people constitute a range of human rights violations, including the right to housing and the rights of indigenous people. Ebole says Amnesty found that the Benet are suffering as the government's promises of protection and resettlement go unkempt.
The multiple interrelated and interconnected human rights violations that the indigenous people of the Benet have suffered following violent forced evictions by the state have deepened the poverty and disparities experienced by this community, leaving them landless, marginalized, and at risk of further human rights violations.
Amnesty International's report says the Benet were first evicted from the forest by the National Forestry Authority in 1983 and subsequently by the Uganda Wildlife Authority, UWA, in 1993 when the Ugandan government declared the forest a national park. The report further notes that in 2008, the UWA forcefully evicted about 200 Benet families, this time targeting members of the community who the UWA claimed were still settled inside the national park, despite the government's allocation of land to them. Amnesty is calling on the government to, among other things, recognize the Benet as indigenous people, recognize their right to their ancestral lands in Mount Elgon, and to ensure that all Benet people who were subject to forcible evictions get remedy and reparations. The organization also demands that all allegations against the UWA be investigated and responsible persons prosecuted. Bashir Hanji, public relations officer for the Uganda Wildlife Authority, describes the Amnesty report as baseless and pure speculation. According to Hanji, the Benet vacated their land for conservation voluntarily and are now going back on that.
It is also not true that UWA is involved in killing people. Why do we kill people? We are a government entity established to be responsible for all protected areas. In the process of taking care of a protected area, we don't allow encroachers. So if there are people who are said to have been evicted, they must have been inside a protected area. We're not doing anything wrong. We're executing our mandate as per the law.
Hanji adds that they were working closely with communities neighboring all protected areas, and the government aims to resettle displaced communities. The Benet are a hunter-gatherer and pastoralist community who many Ugandans refer to as the primitive people of the mountain. Their land issues date back to the colonial period, when the British colonial government first declared the Mount Elgon moorlands and grasslands home to their ancestors as a forest reserve. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
In Zimbabwe, health experts say mental health issues, including substance abuse, are growing and need to be addressed. The government says it's looking to work with local communities to deal with the situation. Ruten Damaweri reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Parire Nyatwa Group of Hospitals includes the largest medical center in Zimbabwe and one of five central hospitals. Tawanda Makombe is the nurse in charge of the psychiatric unit called Annex at Parire Nyatwa Hospital in Harare. Makombe confirms that his staff are seeing an increasing number of emotionally troubled referrals.
Every day we are seeing 10 or 15 patients coming, but for admissions now we have to screen and see which one is very serious, which one needs serious attention. For those who need serious attention, we are talking about very violent patient or aggressive patient, or those who are wandering away from home and who are actually now disturbing the society.
Mental health specialists like Makombe blame substance abuse for the growing number of patients.
Nowadays, we are actually facing a challenge of most our patients are having the diagnosis of substance abuse or alcohol abuse. So we take them in for admission, for rehabilitation, and also detoxification, whereby there is an issue of pharmacotherapy, whereby we use of medication in order to wean off the substance that they were taking, and mainly because of the heavy traffic of those patients who are being admitted, we are now only taking for almost at least 21 days, which is 3 weeks, under our care. Then from there, after 3 weeks, they now go to halfway homes or rehabilitative homes.
Mental health experts say a rise in drug abuse, including the use of crystal meth, cannabis, and even coffee mixtures, is especially prominent among youth. The Zimbabwe Civil Liberties and Drug Network says 80% of those that take illicit drugs are between the ages of 16 and 35. Dr. John Chamunorwa Mangwiro is Zimbabwe's Deputy Minister of Health. He says
the young people who are having problems with drugs, the drugs that help them reduce the craving need to be manufactured locally because they are very expensive where they are ever they are bought. Medication was a bit scarce, but as government I have told you that we are going to encourage local manufacturing of all these things that we're importing.
Authorities say a partnership between the government and local communities is needed to solve the problem. However, they say the government is already taking steps to curb the use of drugs and other substances that lead to mental health problems. The permanent secretary in the Ministry of Health, Air Commodore Dr. Jasper Chimedza, says that about 60% of patients admitted into mental health institutions suffer from drug-related problems. As part of its National Drug Master Plan, authorities are working to eliminate the supply of illicit drugs and over-the-counter medications that can increase usage and addiction. It is also working to rehabilitate addicts with the construction of more halfway homes. However, observers are encouraging the government to improve staffing and the number of medical personnel to help in the effort to improve mental health. The World Health Organization notes a severe shortage of human resources for treating mental health issues in Zimbabwe, which has only 18 psychiatrists. All but one are located in Harare. In addition, there are only 6 psychologists in the country and 917 psychiatric nurses. Without an increase in the number of healthcare specialists, the effort to fight substance abuse and other problems, including mental health disorders like depression, may be an uphill battle. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Netline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, sports, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection.
But first,
several young African climate activists traveled thousands of miles to Glasgow, Scotland, to be part of the COP26 climate summit and to convey their sense of urgency to world leaders. Henry Ridgewell spoke with some of them about their climate change experiences and what COP26 must deliver to help their communities back home.
Africa is at the front line of climate change. The Lake Chad Basin covers almost 8% of the continent. It supports tens of millions of people. The UN says it has shrunk by 90% since the 1960s because of drought driven by climate change. The resulting competition for resources has caused poverty and conflict. Over 10 million people are dependent on humanitarian assistance. 27-year-old Oladosu Adenike is a prominent campaigner on climate change in Africa. She started the Fridays for Future campaign in Nigeria, joining the global movement launched by climate activist Greta Thunberg in 2018.
The peace and stability in this region, in the Lake Chad region, the Sahel, it depends on when we are able to restore the lake and able to see that people get sustainable livelihoods, for them not to be vulnerable to joint armed group of people. And this will likewise improve democracy in the region.
Adenike is an official Nigerian youth delegate at the COP26 summit and says she is frustrated by the slow progress.
We are still in the talking phase. We have not yet transited into the action phase, which is needed right now, this moment, and not postponing it into the future, because that is the most dangerous thing you can do right now, because delay now is now a denial of the climate change crisis.
Kaluki Paul Mutuku is a youth delegate for Kenya. Like Adenike, he's another prominent young voice in the fight against climate change in Africa.
We are constantly in the fear of losing our family members, losing our communities, because the climate is dry. It worsens by the day. There are droughts, there is extreme rainfall, and communities cannot bear with it.
Mutuku says climate change-driven disasters like the locust plague of 2019 are becoming more common in his home country. He says that climate finance, the money that rich countries have agreed to pay to poorer nations to help them adapt to climate change and decarbonize their economies, is the most vital outcome of COP26. Their 2009 pledge to pay $100 billion a year still has not been met.
We cannot afford to lose hope. And as long as young people, grassroots, and our frontline communities are leading the decade of change, then we are in the right trajectory. For me, any delayed financing is a shame to leaders.
For young activists from around the world, it has been a long journey to COP26 in every sense. They say they will continue to fight for climate justice long after they return home. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the COP26 summit in Glasgow, Scotland.
Advocates for media freedom say nations in the Southern African Regional Bloc, SADC, are enacting restrictive cyber laws that have a chilling effect on journalism and freedom of expression. Columbus Mavunga has more from Harare.
In a hybrid forum on the state of internet regulations, Thabani Moyo, the director of Media Institute of Southern Africa, said his organization is worried about a trend toward less tolerance for journalists and dissent in the region. He said the trend began last year after SADC leaders' meeting, where heads of state resolved to take preemptive measures against what they called external interference, the impact of fake news and abuse of social media.
In the wake of this resolution, we have seen a dangerous consensus towards crackdown of expression online. A number of Southern African countries moved with speed to come up with what they referred to as cybersecurity laws and frameworks. To us, somewhat problematic, as the proposed pieces of legislation had serious chilling effects on expression, media freedom, and right to privacy.
The effects have been felt most visible in Tanzania, where the Uhuru newspaper was suspended in August for publishing what authorities called a false story saying President Samia Suluhu Hassan would not run for office in 2025. In September, Raja Mwema, a Swahili language weekly, was suspended for 30 days for reportedly publishing false information and deliberate incitement. Meanwhile, Zambia's government under former President Edgar Lungu used cyber laws to block social media on the pretext the opposition was committing crimes with its posts on Twitter and Facebook. SADC Secretary Elias Mupedi Magosi, in a speech read by SADC Director of Infrastructure Rosemary Mapolayo Mokwena, defended the move toward stronger internet laws.
As more people get connected to access information, it attracts more cyber criminals to our shores. SADC has already commenced the process to review and modernize the SADC cybersecurity legal, regulatory and institutional frameworks. Misinformation being spread on the safety of 5G mobile networks risks has caused a negative impact on the ICT industry.
However, Namibia's Minister of Information and Communication Technology, Pea Mushelenga, called on countries to allow free expression online.
It is thus incumbent upon all role players, development partners, civil society organizations, governments and intergovernmental organizations to reinforce cooperation among each other in order to safeguard and enhance guarantees for the full exercise of the right to information and freedom of expression both online and offline, with a particular focus on strengthening media freedom, diversity, its independence and ability, as well as transparency of digital platforms.
Zimbabwe's Information Minister Monica Mchangwa announced this week the government had set up a cyber team to monitor what people send and receive, a move that has been condemned by many rights groups. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And now in Northern Africa sports, Nigeria and Cape Verde will face off on Tuesday in what will be a grand finale of Group C in the qualifiers for the Qatar 2022 FIFA World Cup after both won their matches on Saturday. Nigeria beat Liberia 2-0 to remain top of the group with 12 points, while Cape Verde came from a goal down to beat Central African Republic 2-1 to remain second with 10 points, 2 behind Nigeria. Meanwhile, Pablo Garnett scored with 6 minutes remaining as Equatorial Guinea beat Tunisia 1-0 in Malabo on Saturday to throw Group B wide open heading to the final match day. Saturday's results mean the two sides are both on 10 points, but the Carthage Eagles have a better goal aggregate. Zambia, who earlier on thrashed Mauritania 4-0, are on 7 points and also have an outside chance of qualification. Tunisia will host Zambia on the final match day, while Equatorial Guinea is away to Mauritania, who are out of contention. Tunisia only need to win against Zambia to be sure of qualification. In Group D, Cameroon's battle with Ivory Coast for one 2022 World Cup playoff spot will go down to the final round of qualifying matches after the Indomitable Lions brushed aside 10-man Malawi 4-0, and later on Saturday, Ivory Coast beat Mozambique 3-0. Ivory Coast is 1 point above Cameroon. Egypt, Mali, Morocco and Senegal have already secured their places in the playoffs, where Africa's 5 representatives in Qatar will be decided. Meanwhile, the group stage of the Maiden CAF Women's Champions League was concluded on Friday. Hazaka's Ladies of Ghana, Malabo Kings of Equatorial Guinea, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa and AS FAR Morocco reached the semi-finals and will compete to be the first ever CAF Women's Champions League winners. Mamelodi Sundowns Ladies and AS FAR joined Hazaka's Ladies and Malabo Kings in the semi-finals of the inaugural Women's African Champions League After the first round of group games in Cairo, Sundowns topped Group B after a goalless draw with ASFA, and the Moroccans progressed after Vihiga Queens were beaten 4-0 by Rivers Angels. Malabo Kings will face Mamelodi Sundowns in the last four, with Hazaka's Ladies of Ghana taking on ASFA. The semi-finals will take place on Monday, with the final on November 19th. And the president of Kenya's Football Federation, FKF, was arrested on Friday as a series of developments threw the country's footballing future in uncertainty. FKF president Nick Mwenda was detained 2 days after Kenya's sports ministry created a caretaker committee to run the federation for 6 months. A recent report commissioned by the Kenya Sports Ministry recommended that authorities should carry out further investigation into FKF. The investigations are intended to establish the extent to which the misappropriation of funds in FKF may have occurred, with a view of prosecuting those who may be found culpable. FIFA officials were recently in Nairobi conducting their own audit into the FKF, which Mwenda has led since 2006. Mwenda has denied any wrongdoing. Kenyan Sports Minister Dr. Amina Mohamed said the FKF had failed to account for monies allocated to it by the government. On Thursday, football's world governing body, FIFA, advised that Kenya is likely to face an international ban unless the actions of the sports minister are undone. FIFA disapproves of government interference in the running of a member association and has banned countries from all forms of football as a result in the past. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports.
Now, let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The King of Morocco attracted much attention to the dispute over Western Sahara when he declared that Morocco would no longer participate in any diplomatic moves or negotiation over Western Sahara. For the king, the sovereignty of Morocco over Western Sahara is a fait accompli. It may also be recalled that when the Security Council recently extended the mandate of the United Nations over Western Sahara, the representative of Polisario in Washington declared that the failure of the Council to tackle the impasse in the negotiations over referendum meant that the extension of the mandate and the appointment of a new representative over Western Sahara would yield nothing. In fact, reaffirming that the Polisario Front would have to find an alternative to receive its goals. The reaction of the Security Council now will be closely watched. But the biggest gain of Morocco was the decision of former President Donald Trump to recognize Morocco's full sovereignty over Western Sahara. This was a challenge to the international consensus that the issue of Morocco is subject to the result of a referendum and that Morocco could not claim full sovereignty. But the reaction was tepid, both from the UN and for the Organization of African Unity. Now the question then for the international community is what next? Or why is Morocco so confident that its defiance of the international consensus would bring no strong reaction? It should recall that when the Organization of African Unity over 3 decades ago recognized the Polisario as the sole representative of the Sahrawi people and then recognized and admitted Polisario as full member of the OAU then, that led Morocco in great anger to leave the OAU. But after a long doldrum of no action on the referendum in Western Sahara, Morocco began a major diplomatic offensive. It first made sure that it had support in the Security Council so there would be no strong reaction to his decision. It then tried to have good diplomatic moves in many African countries and have very close rapprochement with some of the key members of the African Union. When Morocco was confident that its diplomatic rapprochement had succeeded, it then returned to the African Union as full member. So today, Morocco sits alongside Polisario in the African Union and also in the General Assembly with Morocco, because the General Assembly had followed the OAU and recognized Polisario as the sole representative of the Sahrawi people and have representation in the United Nations. Now, what should happen? The Security Council has to react, because the decision of the King of Morocco is a challenge to its authority under Article 25 of the United Nations Charter. It cannot allow this action to go without reaction. Similarly, the African Union, which had admitted Morocco after it had returned, has to do something. Morocco, by the King's declaration, is defying a firm decision by the African Union as a follow-up to the OAU. This is a warning to those cynical pragmatists that have always believed that certain difficult issues should allow to just go fallow. No, it doesn't happen. To ignore such disputes over a long period of time may come to bite states. So this is a time for an urgent decision to know what will be the reaction of the international community to this defiance of its authority. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday here on Northern Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent. Moyo kakuchagua, mdomo ukasema na kupenda. Mwambie umepona, alokutesa moyo kusumbua, maumivu yamekwenda. Pepese wapi mikipofu mwako siona. Penzi limetaradadi na pepewa. Harufu ya marashi rashi nkitachi tachi shingona. Uvae baibui kanga, vietu vya kuchuchumia kangaru. Kisema tuitanga, weubani fukizia pambetu. Ukizungushia shanga, inashuka inapanya chini juu. Nishetafuna karanga, asa chumba ndo kiwanda watoto tu. Yeah, yeah.
kitanda, shuka za maua uwa ya maru, kisha tukonde na vyanta, mambo ya kujizibua na varu, nifunge upande kanga, kapu juma we kwaru wa kwa kwaru. Oh baby,
حبيبي مفيش حاجة نقولها وصلين لدرجة حب محدش في الدنيا وصلها أنا ليك وعمري ما أكون يا حبيبي غير ليك روحي شغلها دي الثانية وانت بعيد ازاي قلبي هيستحملها
And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of The Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a very good evening.